Great, very warm welcome to the Oxford Martin School. I'm Ian Golden, I'm the director of the school, and we're very proud to be collaborating with the Oxford Literary Festival this year for the use of our premises for events. This is an interdisciplinary community of about 350 scholars thinking about the big challenges of the future. And today we're going to be talking about a series of questions around the topic, Is the Planet Full? This will be appearing as a book in May. I'm afraid the book isn't quite out yet, but you can order copies downstairs from Blackwell's or from Amazon, and I know it's in the works because it's left our control. I'm delighted to be joined today by four colleagues who've contributed. There are actually eight different contributors to the book, but four of us are here today. Toby Ord, who is from our Future of Humanity group, a philosopher, Professor Sarah Harper, who is the director of the Oxford Institute of Aging in the Oxford Martin School, demographer, Professor Charles Godfrey, who is the director of our Future of Food and Farming group, a zoologist, and Professor Robin Norton, who is the co-director of our George Institute, who is a doctor. So we are, and I'm an economist, so we are an interdisciplinary group, and what this book has done is approach this question of whether the planet is full from a very wide variety of perspectives. The book really arises out of a question that James Martin, who is the founder of the Oxford Martin School, always used to pose to me. He basically posed this question, he unfortunately died last October. And there's a dedication plaque in the entrance hall of this building to him, and the book is dedicated to him. So I wish he could have seen it, but he certainly heard the arguments and met with all of us and engaged on this topic many, many times. This is not a new question. In fact, there's historical records of debates around this issue which go round to the time of Christ and the 2,000 years and beyond ago. And most of the debates around this over time, and then of course the very famous debates of Malthus and others that engaged in it, have been rather pessimistic on this question. When it was first engaged with, the world's population was about 2 million, and was pessimistic then. I don't think the level of pessimism has grown, but the first chapter of the book, which I write, reviews some of this literature on the background to this debate and brings us up to date as to where it largely is now in terms of our time. There's been lots of books that I'm sure many of you read, like The Population Bomb, The Club of Rome, and many other reports which address this topic from different perspectives. And really suggests that we can only understand this question in the context of an interdisciplinary conversation, approaching it from multiple dimensions, ranging from ethical to those of climate change and others. And that's really what the book seeks out to do. So we want to give you a flavor of it by very briefly introducing some of these chapters and then have a little discussion amongst ourselves to demonstrate that we do actually think in an interdisciplinary way and then open it up for discussion for the last 10, 15 minutes or so. So we're going to begin with the demography, Sarah Harper.
Okay. Thank you very much. When you think of Is the Planet Full, obviously population is one of the things you tend to think about. And if I say that 25 years ago we were convinced that the planet was going to reach 24 billion by the end of this century, and we now think that will probably be only about 10 or 11 billion. So from a population growth point of view, things have changed quite dramatically. And the reason is that across the globe, women have chosen to have fewer children. So much so that two-thirds of the countries of the world, women are choosing to have round about two children, and therefore those countries are at, near, or below replacement level. And as a consequence, we tend to think of how the population is changing in its composition, its density, and its distribution. And I think the emphasis has shifted away from population numbers onto the area of consumption. Now, we shouldn't be surprised that this has happened, because those of you who know the traditional ideas around demographic transition know that as we economically grow, education and health improves, and so we have, first of all, mortality falling, populations expand, and then birth rates start to fall. And so what happened here in Europe in the 18th and 19th century, big expansion of the European population. Now the European population actually is stable and to a certain extent declining. We see big expansion of the Asian population at the moment. It will hit about 4.5 billion by the middle of the century. Then it too will start to decline and end up around about 4 billion. And then from about 2050 onwards, we'll see the African population really start to expand. But what is more important is where will these people be living and what will they be doing and how will that drive the consumption of the planet's resources? So in terms of where people are going to be living, we're becoming so much more urban. About half the world's population currently live in cities. That will go to about 75% by about 2050. And by the end of the century, 80 or even 90% of us will be living in urban regions. And that will have huge implications for our relationship with the natural environment. And then in terms of the distribution of the population, in terms of its age composition, because when we have young people who are driving our economies, those economies tend to be very high in material consumption. And when we have older populations, traditionally, material consumption has tended to go down. So we can say that in the advanced economies, we typically are getting older. We soon will have around about a third of the populations of advanced economies aged over 60. But one of the reasons why Asia is having this economic boom, people argue, is because that's where the world's workers are. So by the middle of this century, we'll have 2.5 billion people of working age in Asia, compared with only around 300 million here in Europe. And therefore, the big argument is, will these people be driving those economies and consuming resources? Or are we going to see youth bulges, social unrest, unemployment? So when we look at things in terms of consumption, I think the really big argument links into what my colleagues are going to talk about. There's a huge ethical issue about overconsumption here in advanced economies and underconsumption in particularly some of the African and Asian economies. Now, I'll just give you an example, and I know that Jeff Godfrey's going to pick up on this when he talks about food. If you look at the consumption of calories across the world, here in advanced economies, particularly in the US and some of the European nations, we have tremendous overconsumption of calories, and therefore that threatens with obesity and the kind of chronic diseases that obesity leads to. And at the same time, on the same planet, we have underconsumption of calories in some of the sub-Saharan African countries, leading to malnutrition. And I think going forward, those kind of inequalities in consumption is going to be something that the world is going to find increasingly difficult to accept. So the really big question, I think, going forward is not the numbers of people, but our interaction with our environment, and particularly our consumption of the material goods of that environment. And the fact that I think advanced economies have got to adjust themselves. We may still have what we call economic consumption, in so much as we may still want to raise the well-being of our populations, increase education, increase healthcare, but it's very difficult for us to justify the material consumption of the Earth's resources when we have huge populations in the south who really need to increase their economic consumption in order to raise their well-being and quality of life.
Great, thanks very much. Charles.
Thanks, Ian. I know you're meant to get sort of more morose as you get older, but I have to admit that I'm getting more cheerful. And the reason I'm getting more cheerful is essentially what Sarah has just said, that we are seeing human population growth going down. And my academic background is sort of mathematical population biology. And when I was half my age today, that I am today, one just couldn't conceive of that happening. So I really think, to put it crudely, it's game on. We have the opportunities for human population growth to come to a plateau and with a soft landing, which I never believed until the last decade or so. But exactly as Sarah said, the real issue is, can we support 10 or 11 billion people with levels of consumption? So it all boils down to consumption, and I want to talk about one element of that consumption, which is food. Before talking about what we might have to do ahead, then I think looking back recently over the last couple of decades on foods, there are two interesting things. First of all, for us in the rich world, one of the problems has been the overproduction of food. So our policy has been geared around how we prevent our farmers from producing too much food, because food prices over the last couple of decades have been historically cheap, at least for us in the rich world. In the UK, we spend 10% of our income on food. Probably at no time since money was invented has a society spent as little as food as we do in the rich West. But of course, it's very different in the poor world. In the poor world, there has been substantial progress on hunger. That's another reason I'm an optimist. But still, sadly, round about 800 million people go to bed calorie hungry at night. Now, a really important thing which we must remember is that you sometimes hear people say, well, the world can produce enough food to feed everyone. Surely there shouldn't be a problem in hunger. People are outraged that the world can produce enough food and people go hungry. Well, I think you should be outraged, but not for the simple reason that we could redistribute that. I think that's naive. As the great economic philosopher Amartya Sen has written over the last 20 or 30 years, the reason our people are poor is that they cannot afford to buy food. So I think you should be outraged that we have failed to allow countries to develop in such a way that they can't produce enough food. So that's where we are today, where there is probably not a huge problem with food, although there's a great problem with people not being able to afford food. But what happens if we look into the future when we have a couple of extra billion people and a couple of billion people who are demanding much more meat in their diet, for example, resources that take a lot of food to produce? Well, there I think we have a real challenge, and the challenge is to maintain food prices at such a level that the poorest, especially the poorest in big tropical megacities, don't literally run out of food because they can't afford to do it. And I think a dispassionate look at the challenges ahead, which is what we try and do in the book, says that action has to be taken on all fronts. And this has to rise higher up the policy agenda than it does at the moment. And just a brief word on what those different fronts are. We have to produce more food, but we have to produce it with less impact on the environment. The way we produce food today is literally unsustainable. We're undermining our capacity to produce food in the future. 100 years ago, we'd have just brought more land into agriculture, but there is essentially no new land. Well, there is the Amazon, but as Nick Stern said a few years ago, the best way to get carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is to cut down rainforest. So we need a real effort in what I call sustainable intensification. More food from the same amount of land, but with less impact on the environment. We need to think about diets. It's literally impossible for 11 billion people, 10 billion people, to enjoy the diets we have in the rich world. I'm afraid we're going to have to eat less meat. There's no way around it. And finally, we have to do sensible things to the governance of the food system. We have to make globalization work in favor of poor people throughout the world. We need to have an interconnected series of bread baskets so that when climate change leads to a major shock in one area, it doesn't wreck food supplies throughout the world. And we have to do far more sensible things about the way we support agriculture in the rich world, both in Europe with the Common Agricultural Policy and in the States. And that's my time up.
Great, thanks very much, Charles. Robin, can we all be healthy?
Great. The question that I've asked in this book is really the question of whether healthcare or the potential lack of healthcare is likely to be a constraint to population growth and indeed quality of life in coming years. And I've argued that yes, that is the case, unless we change the current models of healthcare dramatically. Currently in high-income countries, as you would know, in the UK, the US, we cannot afford the current levels of healthcare that we have at the moment. So governments in the UK, in the US, are looking at ways in which we can reduce the costs of healthcare while maintaining or improving the quality of that care. So there has to be a radical shift in the way in which we provide healthcare in high-income countries. In low- and middle-income countries, already a large majority of the population does not have access to safe, effective and affordable health care. So we, but as Sarah has indicated, with economic growth, the aspirations of many people in low and middle income countries is that they will have access to the same levels of healthcare that we have in countries like the UK and the US. But we cannot afford to follow those. Currently, the levels of healthcare spending in those countries is dramatically less than what we have in the US and the UK, and those countries cannot afford to ramp up their health systems to provide the sort of care that we're providing in high-income countries at the moment. So again, there will need to be dramatically different models of healthcare introduced in those countries if those governments are to provide healthcare for their populations. What that means is those dramatic changes are going to require us to think about task shifting. How do we look at utilising low-cost healthcare workers compared to the very high-cost healthcare workers that we have at the moment? How do we move people away from utilising high-cost health services, hospitals, keep them out of hospitals? How do we ensure that we provide preventive health care? Can we use low-cost technologies as part of the solution to providing better health care? Can we provide access to lower-cost drugs and devices? These are all some of the solutions that we need to think about if we're going to provide healthcare for the majority of the world's population. What I have done in the presentation, in the chapter, is focus firstly on what are some of the drivers that are changing the healthcare landscape that we have at the moment, that are driving healthcare costs and are likely to continue to drive healthcare costs. And then secondly, I've focused on some of those solutions that I've referred to using the work that we've been undertaking in low and middle income countries in China and India, for example, and suggesting that can some of those activities that we're undertaking be transferred to the high income countries like the UK. If we look at some of the drivers of the changes in healthcare at the moment, they are, as Sarah has alluded to, growing economic health, urbanisation, and also population ageing. All of these have driven changes in consumption patterns. Tobacco consumption is high in high-income countries, but we're going to see a massive increase in tobacco consumption, most likely in low- and middle-income countries. We're also seeing changes in food consumption. Again, as others have alluded to, we're seeing significant changes from the diets that people were consuming in low- and middle-income countries to the diets that people are consuming in high-income countries, with very high fat content, salt consumption. We're also seeing decreases in physical activity. Already a third of the population is deemed to be physically inactive. And as people move into the cities, they become less physically active as well. All of these sorts of changes lead to significant increases in overweight and obesity. We're seeing massive changes. Already there's about 500 million people in the population deemed to be obese, and those changes are starting to occur more and more in low-income countries. What has happened as a consequence is we're seeing a massive change from communicable disease to non-communicable diseases as the causes of death. Indeed, people are living longer, but they're living longer often with chronic disease. One of the functions of chronic disease is that you have to change the healthcare systems. So whereas previously people were seeking acute care for the conditions that they had, people require ongoing care to manage those chronic diseases. And that is what is driving the healthcare costs in high-income countries at the moment, and indeed, as lower middle income countries increase in the numbers with chronic disease, they're also seeing those increases in they're also seeing the increases in the numbers who are needing care for chronic disease. So the solutions have to be looking at using low healthcare cost workers to manage this, looking at low technology, computer systems that will help us. Mobile phones in particular are part of the solution to this, and providing poly pills, pills that are off patent, that people can use, that are low cost. But the challenge will be is how do we take those solutions into high income countries? They're really going to decrease the costs in low income countries and can be used in those countries. The challenge is bringing them into high income countries as well.
Thanks, Robin. Many of the issues that we were grappling with are of an ethical nature. How do we think about unborn generations, the future, and the idea that we should limit population? And so we were delighted to be able to have Toby Ward as a group.
Hi, my chapter is called Overpopulation or Underpopulation. And in it, I try to ask a few philosophical and ethical questions, framing the nature of these debates. So when you hear the title, Is the Planet Full?, you might be thinking mainly about overpopulation. It's interesting, you know, to hear already how that's not exactly the story that we're talking about. The changing internal dynamics are also very relevant. But a lot of people have a narrative or framing of this where they think that it's pretty obvious that the world is overpopulated, and the question is how many people could it support, maybe, you know, a billion fewer than now or something like that. It's very interesting to hear that that was also thought in a time where there were only 2 million people, so less than a thousandth as many people as there are now. So that was, if they thought that was full, then they were unbelievably wrong, which is worth bearing in mind. Now, I don't know, as it happens, whether it would be better if we had more people or if we had fewer people. And that's the topic of my chapter. It turns out that as well as producing bad effects, which we're very familiar with, having more people can also produce some good effects. So I divide these into two different categories. First, I think about the instrumental benefits of having more people, and then I also think about the intrinsic benefits of having more people. So first, the instrumental, which are perhaps easier to understand. So if you add people to the world, this can produce benefits for the people who are already going to exist anyway. So imagine if you had a world of 7 billion, or if you had a world of 8 billion, if the population increases by another billion, that can provide benefits to the 7 billion who would exist anyway. We're familiar with many of these types of benefits. For example, if you have a child, that might enrich your life a lot compared to if you didn't have that child. I think that on a global level, one of the biggest types of benefit that new people create comes from information goods. So I'll say a little bit about that. A physical good is something like a hammer, where you produce the good in a factory, perhaps, and then one person gets to benefit from it, the person who has the hammer. An information good is something like a song, or maybe like a piece of software, where once you've created it, the pattern of information is basically free to distribute. Whether you charge people or not is a question about how you're going to make your money and licensing and so forth. But in terms of the benefit for the world, once you produce one of Shakespeare's plays, everyone can benefit from it. And so the scaling is very different for those. If you doubled the world's population, you'd have twice as many of these information goods, which the existing group part of the population could share in. And so as the world economy has shifted increasingly towards information goods, for example, everything we do in academia is an information good, and also software, also music, also all of literature or poetry, all of plays are information goods. These are things that scale up, and there's more instrumental benefits the more people you have. One way to think about that is if there were twice as many people, we could achieve the same amount of information goods all working half as long. So that would be a benefit for us all, is that we could have much more leisure time and achieve the same amount of cultural things that we have available. So that's the interesting kind of area where you can see that there can be good effects from having more people. as well as bad effects on the others. Another issue is the intrinsic benefits, which is perhaps a little bit harder to grasp and more philosophical. But if you imagine, we often blithely talk about that it might be good to have a billion fewer people or something like that. But we don't really think about the individuals who would constitute this billion people and the value of their lives to themselves. So, for example, I think that if we take the set of islands which constitute the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland, there have been many great things that have happened on these islands. If you look at the span of time from before any people came here to the present day, fewer than a billion lives have been lived on these islands. But I think that if you look at all of the hopes and dreams of these people and all of the little things and the great things in their lives, even ignoring the effect of these people on the rest of the world, that something really good is there. And you know, if we hadn't had that, we would have lost something of great value. And so that's an extra aspect there. In terms of ethics, people debate this type of question. Some people think that, for example, what's important with a population is just the average level of welfare, whereas other people think that that it also matters how many people there are, so the total level of welfare. So if there were, if we were to have only 2 million people on this world, even if they had the same standard of living as we have now, that there would be something of great, you know, great loss there, in that, you know, many of us wouldn't get to exist and so forth. So in my chapter, I look at these types of issues. I ask this question about what would therefore be the ideal way to balance up these benefits and these losses of population, and try to, you know, push a little bit into that, although I don't come to any firm conclusions. I'm not sure whether the world is currently overpopulated or not. I don't mean to say that it is underpopulated, but I rather mean to say, what's the ideal level, and to try to raise that as a question, rather than simply assuming the ideal level is much smaller than the current level.
Great, thanks very much, Toby. In the concluding chapter, I try to pull this all together, not only from what you've heard from my four colleagues today, but also from the four others that aren't here. A great chapter on economics by Sir Tony Atkinson, which focuses on inequality and issues around that. An excellent chapter on water, an excellent chapter on materials and what can the Earth produce sustainably, and an excellent chapter on climate and associated issues. Where much of this comes out, as I think you've already picked up from what you've heard, is that it really depends not on how many people there are, but how we manage ourselves and the planet. And it's not really about the numbers. There are many examples of hundreds of millions of people living in absolutely terrible conditions, and there are many of them living in splendid conditions. There are cities like Singapore, where there's 7,000 people per square kilometer, who have much higher living standards in many respects than places where there's only three people per square kilometer. So it's not about the density or the numbers, it's about something else. It's about not only how these people are able to manage their lives, but also, crucially, increasingly, how they interact with the rest of the planet. So the spillover effects. And one of the things that happens as more and more people come into the world, and as we get wealthier, is that our spillover impacts become much greater. So increasingly we move from a world where individuals can basically, and communities can determine their own futures, to a world in which everything we do becomes interdependent. And indeed this is the topic of the book I launched yesterday, The Butterfly Defect, which is about interdependencies. So how one manages these interdependencies is important. Many people, and it's been referred to, have pointed to the fact that very scarce, water-scarce places, let's think of Phoenix, Arizona, seem to be attracting very high levels of inflow. That there are many places which have suffered famine where there is no shortage of food, and there are many places where there's abundance of food where there are other problems. So the politics matters, and governance really is central to this. Education is extremely helpful, hasn't been mentioned, and Wolfgang Lutz and others have shown the relationship between education levels and ability to manage problems. But there's something else, and I think this was hinted at by Toby, which is this idea of the release of innovative ability. The more of us there are, and the more connected we are, and the more educated we are, the more problem solvers there are in the world. So the release of individual genius just on a random distribution, but also collective, because teams and people working together are much more effective. So there can be an optimism that as we get more educated and connect, we're more able to understand the implications of our actions on others and on the planet. A crucial question which Tony Atkinson deals with is that related to inequality, not only inequality, but the self-reinforcing tendency of inequality and the capture by governments of by elites, cronyism, greed, and other factors. And that is a severe problem. It's not about how many people in your society, it's what share of them are involved in decision making and to what end, and whether that is in society's interests in a small or not. A key variable as well, which is the subject of my book, Exceptional People, is migration. This has always been the way that the planet has resolved issues of population pressure, food pressure, climate pressure, conflict, etc. People moved, and none of us would be here if that hadn't been the way that our forefathers have resolved their problems. That option is being closed out with countries building higher and higher walls. And so whether one thinks the planet is full or not partly depends about whether one thinks that people can move from one place to another in the future or not, and how that will play out. So it's absolutely crucial to the debate. The Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations was an activity that the school engaged in, bringing some very wise people together to think about how one gets to deal with these governance issues. Because the proliferation of people also leads to the proliferation of views and identities and more countries, 207 or something different entities now. Can we begin to agree do more people mean more problems in decision making at the collective level? And there's some evidence that it does lead to make decision making more difficult, and coordination becomes more complex, attribution becomes more complex, and so governance is absolutely key. What we talk about, and which I refer to in the concluding chapter, is the need to think in new ways, the need to think about coalitions, the role of different actors, like cities becoming key organizing agents, not countries or governments, and cities of the world as they are getting together on many activities, fit cities on health, climate change cities on climate, etc. So not relying on the old models to solve these problems. And that is a source of immense optimism. Cities coping with 16, 20 million people in ways that governments seem incapable of doing in resolving the issues across their things. And of course, we see the success of London in this regard. In the end, where I come out, and this is, as academics never have collective views, so in the concluding chapter, is that it's really not about the numbers. It's about this question of whether our connectivity and this release of innovative ability around the world as people become educated, as the walls come down and they begin to understand the issues, be they climate change or be they food scarcity or water scarcity, the spillover effects of our individual actions, that it's really about our ability to comprehend that it's not about the numbers, it's about our ability to live in harmony with the planet and our fellow human beings. And that's really the key message of the book, with some, I hope, practical ideas as well along the way in the different chapters and the concluding chapter as to how this may be achieved. So that's the book. We'll now just take a few minutes bouncing off each other in terms of how some of the different chapters feed into each other, and then I'll open it up to the floor. Who'd like to go first? Toby.
Sure. This is perhaps for Sarah and Charles, that I just want to check that I'm right about this, trying to perhaps strengthen one of the things you were saying. So in the 1950s, the world's population really was growing at an extreme rate. There's a figure, statistic called the total fertility rate, which is, I think, the number of children per woman in the world on average. In the 50s, that figure was at around about 5, and the replacement rate is around about 2.33. So that's the number of children per woman you need in order to maintain a level population. So it was around about twice what it needed to be. So it was 100% growth per generation in terms of the population. So you know, it was doubling per generation. Now, I mean, I don't know if you care to hazard a guess as to what the total fertility rate is, but I said that the replacement rate is 2.33. As far as I understand from the most recent statistics, the current world rate is 2.36. So it's just around about 1% above the replacement rate. That said, that the population is growing faster than 1%, but that's due to, I think, demographic inertia. So the effects that there are a lot of young people from back when it was growing really quickly, and those people still are going to have children, which will create an extra kind of boom, like the echo of the baby boom.
Let's hear from Sarah. She's the expert on this.
Is that correct?
You're nearly there.
Okay.
Not quite. Okay. So the thing about the total fertility rate, it is the number per woman of reproductive age.
Yep.
So the age structure of your population is really important, because if you have a lot of children, or if you have a lot of older women, basically post about 50, mm-hmm. then your future population is going to change in different ways. And I think one of the things that you talked about, which is important, is you called it demographic inertia. It's actually called demographic momentum.
Oh, sorry.
So when we're talking about the fact that when we looked at the world as a whole in the 1950s, and we seem to have very high total fertility rates, what we have to do is see where were those fertility rates. And what basically has happened is that the European and particularly many of the Asian countries have come down dramatically below replacement. Replacement, we say around about 2.1, 2.12, but of course it depends on the overall age structure of your population. And in fact, the lowest total fertility rates are not here in Europe, they're actually now in Asia. And we talk about the shelf generation. These are women who may have 10 siblings and they're having one or no children. Dramatic fall. And whereas it took us about 150 years in Europe to go from relatively young to relatively older populations, it's going to happen almost in a generation. 25 years, these countries are going from being predominantly young to being predominantly old. So the picture is, as I said, two-thirds of the world's countries are now below replacement. Their women are having roughly around about two or below two. The European and Southeast Asian countries are below 1.5 children, and some of these countries are really worried that they're not going to have enough children to be able to actually drive their economies, let alone boost and increase them. But the real focus is on Africa. So Africa's total fertility rate is between 4 and 7 across the whole of the region. It's on average 7 in Nigeria. That's the average. So you have some of those, and I say girls because it's not really women, it's girls who in their teen and early 20s may have 10 children. They're getting married at 10, 11, 12, 13, at some of the older ages. And that comes back to the argument that Ian said, which is the role of education. Education is so crucial. Education keeps girls in schools. It gives them skills. It gives them the mindset to be able to control their fertility. So the really big focus of overpopulation, if there is one, is in Africa. If the current trend in the total fertility rate in Africa doesn't change, we will have 15 billion Africans by the end of this century. Now, we believe it will change. We believe that as education and economic development and healthcare comes to the region, so their total fertility rate will come down. And the UN presumes that it will come down from about 2050 onwards. So between 2050 and the end of the century, we will have the African countries converging on replacement level. And I think it will be somewhere around about that. But actually, 2 years ago, we thought maximum world population was going to be 10 billion and that the African population by the end of the century would be about 3 billion. Within a year, the UN had raised that to 11 billion because they're not sure that the African population is actually going to reduce its childbearing. So it's a really important point, but it's very complex, and that leads in a way to the different demands we see for healthcare and food and other forms of consumption.
Charles.
I have a question for Toby, but just to repeat what Sarah says then, on the background of being generally optimistic, the thing that scares me most is sort of very small differences between replacement rate and Africa. Africa could have a soft landing, it could be horrible. But I have a question for Toby, and it's about your instrumental goods and whether they actually do scale with increasing population. You mentioned two examples, songs and things, and also scientific research. Well, I'm not sure I agree with you, because I think there's a sort of limit to the number of songs we can hum. And I'm not sure we need more songs, so I'm not sure the utility of songs is going up. Dare I say at a literary festival, perhaps we don't need more books. And in fact,
where are this book? Should I ask
apart from our books. And that there is an element of the tyranny of choice. And then scientific research, well, we're biased here. We can't really, it should be you, not us, that says whether that's a good. But actually, scientific research is an economic thing. It doesn't scale with population. Most scientific research is done from the stable population. It's an economic thing. So my challenge to you is instrumental, are the instrumental goods actually scaling with population?
Oh, that's a good question. In fact, I didn't claim that they were. What I claimed in the bit where I gave a numeric claim was that that you could reduce the inputs per person by a factor of two if you doubled the population and get the same amount of outputs. I wasn't claiming that if you doubled the inputs, you would get twice the outputs. So it could be that there's diminishing marginal returns on a lot of these things. That could definitely be the case. But there are various ways in which we could all take, all of those of us who are kind of engaging in this information economy could perhaps have more leisure time or something like that. You can get the benefits in various ways from that. Or if you had 10% more people, you could have 10% more leisure time among software developers and produce the same amount of software, you know, for the same niches. Or alternatively, you could spend that by trying to get into more niches, which perhaps has diminishing returns, as you suggest.
The problem when you invite academics to talk with each other is you can go on for a long time and you'll all have different views, even if it's on the same topic. I actually believe there's huge informational benefits, and we might not need more books, but we need more ideas. We can't solve the world's problems yet, climate change or many others. And actually, I just am longing for the billion new university graduates that are studying around the world over the next 20 years to get into the system and contribute, because we need them. And the more they are, I think the quicker we'll solve our problems. So, but Oxford, of course, will remain a very special place in that. So the floor is open, is there a roving mic? Yeah. All right. If you'd like to direct your question to any individual in particular, do say so. Otherwise,
I don't think we're looking for more books. We're looking for better books.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But can I make a point? Is it some of our dietary habits are sort of very cultural? I wonder, some new thinking, like eating insects, or is there any good scientific reason why a healthy badger should not be on the nation's plate?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to collect a few questions. Charles, I know, has been working with badgers on badgers. the woman over here. Is there someone there? Back, yeah.
Well, I suppose I just, I'm a paediatrician with an interest in nutrition, and I just feel, taking the arguments of not enough food, and we still have a lot of people who go to bed hungry, and the health issue of obesity, which is a massive problem in Europe and in all Western developed countries, somewhere we must be able to try and make sure that in the future the optimal diet is used as widely as possible and doesn't lead to massive over eating and obesity.
Yep, I imagine that's a question for both of these two. Yeah.
I'm a lapsed geographer and with an interest in environmental conservation, and I think it's a fantastic book and we need to hear it all, but I feel a little bit like it's been going on. We've heard the same debates over and over again, and I just want to ask, is anybody really listening? Because we have short-term government with these long-term objectives that don't seem to get much focus. And the other thing is, I find, is the planet full? I want to answer that question with including all the other species that are there who may have a different response to the question.
My point actually follows on from what you said, which was your basic synopsis in a nutshell, I presume, is better managed means that we could probably cope. How on earth do we get this to be managed? It's a huge political, economical, massive question.
All right, we'll take, is this block finished? There's one more there, and then we'll respond and we'll come over to the side.
For the last speaker, you spoke about the population benefits and intrinsic benefits for humanity if the population increased. I was wondering what your view would be on the benefits for the bigger picture, which would be the benefits for the actual environment if we were to have that population increase.
Yep, so that's related to the previous question. Okay, why don't we quickly come back on this to give time for one more round so that the other half of the room gets a chance to ask questions. Should we just work across? Do you want to talk about badgers and eating insects?
Some excellent points there, that what we eat really does depend on norms. My formal title at Oxford is the Professor of Entomology. By background, I'm interested in insects. So I've tried eating them. They're pretty horrible. I so agree about the importance of obesity. That is so critical. A lot of work's been done on that. We have to change the way we market food. And then the point at the front, I think, is very good about what's happening. And to a certain extent, what needs to happen is a greater public discourse on these issues, of which a meeting like this is part of it, because we need to sort of legitimize our politicians to move further than they can at the moment. And it's not an exact parallel, but it is a parallel. We've known smoking kills us for 50 years. It's only in the last 10 years or so that we as civil society have allowed our politicians to bring in such things as you can't smoke in a restaurant. We need to legitimize our politicians to take as hard decisions on these various other issues.
Commenting around the obesity and things like tobacco consumption, these are issues primarily at the moment in high-income countries, and it's taken a long time to get us to where we are in high-income countries. As with some of the other things we've talked about, what's happening in lower middle-income countries is happening dramatically. So there's going to be a dramatic shift in the numbers of tobacco consumers, the numbers of people with obesity in high-income countries. But on the other hand, we are starting to learn how to deal with these problems in high-income countries. So the benefits of learning in high-income countries, as long as they can be moved also into low- and middle-income countries, may mean that we can stem the tide in those low- and middle-income countries to a greater degree than we have in high-income countries. I'm optimistic in terms of government's response to dealing with issues of healthcare provision. If you look in this country, for example, we cannot afford to continue in this way. We cannot keep the costs of healthcare as it is at the moment. So we've got to find solutions. And a lot of government funding is going into finding solutions to how we improve healthcare while keeping the costs low. So there is increasing government recognition that there does need to be intervention by government to make a change. So I'm optimistic that people are saying, enough's enough, we need to do something about it now.
I see a lot of GPs and doctors in the audience, and they're the coalface of this. Sarah.
I was just going to pick up on what Robin was saying, which is about governments, and I think it isn't just in healthcare. There are many other population issues. It is happening now, and governments are beginning to realise. And just to give you an example, the nine scientific academies in Europe have now produced a demography statement about Europe's population, so that the EU has real demographic evidence to be able to look at the way its population is changing. And we know that many African governments are becoming very interested in their population size, although sadly some are buying into the idea that allowing women to have the possibilities to have fewer children is a good thing, but we do still have some governments who are actively pursuing population growth because they still think that numbers equals economic prosperity. But yes, governments are beginning to engage with population again.
And even some churches are too. Toby.
In terms of the environmental downsides of having more people, I definitely think that there are downsides. And the main purpose of my chapter is more that I assumed everyone else would be talking about the costs of having more people. I want to talk a little bit about the benefits and suggest they need to be weighed against each other. There is, as Ian said earlier, also this aspect that we could have more people than we have today, but have less environmental negative impact than we have today by just being better about it. And so partly it's it's a mixture of overpopulation and overconsumption, those types of costs. And I think we could potentially get some of the benefits without the costs if we were more sensible about this, although that's easier said than done.
There are chapters in the book that deal with biodiversity and impact on the environment, and I also deal with it in my chapters because there's a whole body of evidence around how incomes change and how the destructiveness on the environment change. There's also a very interesting debate about exporting pollution. For example, Germany is nice and clean, but that's because it relies on Polish coal and French nuclear. And so we joining this thing up is extremely important, and thinking on the cradle to grave, not only for an individual product and service like energy, but also planetary. I just want to respond to the points about short-termism and management, and then come back to you for more discussion. This issue of short-termism is absolutely central, and the myopic behavior, not only of governments, but of individuals, so we all want to take our antibiotics, but if we all do it, they will become less effective, or we want to eat a fish, and the price, they'll just become extinct, or whatever. And that's why we created the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations. It's all about how do you overcome short-termism bias in societies. And one of the strong recommendations is the need to use different organizing bases for decision-making, relying less, particularly in democracies which have very short-term political horizons, on central government and more on local and other institutions which have a longer-term relationship with citizens. But also there's some other recommendations on there. The management challenge is the central one. And if there's time, I'll come back to it, but I do want to give others a chance to come in. All right. I'm going to give the tail of that side. Let's just start on this end and work back. If you keep your questions short, we just hopefully will have enough time.
Nobody's
for everyone
mentioned
to
South America. And my abiding image of walking about in Rio is teenage children and younger, or teenage girls and younger, very pregnant, and many, many of them. Where does South America come into your?
Okay. Yep, the woman in front there.
The statistics must be very difficult to work out when you've got millions of people living in refugee camps, receiving aid and destabilized agricultural communities all over the place. And they don't seem to be coming to it. And another thing, a lot of uneducated people, so-called uneducated, living in rural communities are often more intelligent than educated people about the earth and, you know, understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, we talked about the demographic transition, i.e. Falling mortality followed by falling fertility. Do we know what the causation methodology is, causation mechanism?
Yeah. Go backwards. The woman in the back.
In your calculation of dropping population in Asia, how significant a factor is the Chinese one-child policy? And how do you view this? You can do it briefly.
Just one question. In your panel of experts, and designing new systems effectively, or redefining how we go about it, how much attention do you pay to the psychology of the people in general? We talk about short-termism and myopia. I'm not all that optimistic that that's not a fixed value, that it can be changed particularly. And if you're going to change the paradigm, then you need to take that into account rather than just push it away.
Okay. I'm afraid that's all we're going to have time for, because we've only got 4 minutes left and we've got 5 hours to answer questions. If there are questions that are in your mind that you haven't had a chance to ask, do try and call us immediately after this and pose us the questions. Sarah, I think most of them were demographic.
I can whip through that. There are three main demographic. One is on Latin America. It may seem that all these teenagers are having lots and lots of children, and there obviously is a huge diversity, but basically, with the exception of Bolivia and Paraguay, most countries in Latin America are now just above replacement, and Chile is actually below replacement. The endless debate around the causes of the demographic transition, which we have thousands and thousands of papers on this over the last probably 100 years, but basically it seems to be that economic development leads to increased health, which leads to falling mortality, particularly infant mortality. Women begin to realize that if they're going to have 10 babies, these babies are suddenly going to live and they're going to have to bring up 10 children, so they reduce their fertility. So they, yes, in response, but in between the population does grow and that puts pressures on the system. But once that fertility comes down, the increases in health, women being able to take advantages of education, means that that fertility tends to stay low. So that they tend to be the spurs, falling healthcare and education, and then of course the availability of family planning. But it is very, very complex and it hasn't exactly played out in the same way across the globe. And then finally, the one-child policy. People always ask about the one-child policy, but if you look at the rates in which the total fertility rate came down throughout Asia, particularly urban Asia, and that includes South and Southeast Asia, as well as China, actually, all the one-child policy did was kickstart a fall, which we have seen elsewhere in Asia. So I think it was important in the context of the huge number of children in the 1970s in China, but in fact, the rest of Asia has actually followed a very similar path as well.
Great, I just came back from Beijing yesterday, before yesterday, and long discussions on this, and actually one of the interesting things that China's neighbours, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, much lower fertility rates than they do now. The other issue which hasn't come up from the panel or from your questions is gender imbalance, which is actually a dramatic issue. Which of course will lead to further rapid decreases in population numbers. Charles?
Just very briefly, I thought it was a very good point about bringing in psychology more. I think that we're seeing, especially in economics, a much more sophisticated view about the way humans make behavior. I think we're seeing in terms of the behavioral change unit and government, this being taken seriously. It needs to be taken more seriously, but I did think that was an important point. Yeah.
And interestingly enough, it is also a topic we discuss in the Oxford Martin Commission for Future Generations. And there is evidence that people, that group and individual psychology regarding their time horizons does change over time and their political reaction to it. Partly of what age they are, but also what's happening in their society. And when societies are subject to lots of shocks, economic crises, pandemics or others, will get much more short-term. So that plays into it. I'm afraid that's all we have time for. The good news is that the book covers many of these issues in much greater depth than we haven't been able to. Keep your questions in mind because the book won't be out for about another 6 weeks. But as I say, you can go downstairs and there are books by Sarah and by me downstairs, the book I launched yesterday, and some others on related topics, which we'll be signing immediately after this. Do also look at the website of the Oxford Martin School, not only for the commission report, which is downloadable off that, but also a whole series of different events related to these topics. All of us give seminars, give lectures, and there's another 325 or something of them too. So there's lots of further nourishment for these conversations in our events, which are open generally to the public. Thanks to you all for coming. And